Out the Box is brought to you by the South African Jewish Museum. Preserving our past, celebrating the present, and inspiring our future.
Good morning and welcome to Out the Box. For minds that don't fit the mold, but hearts that keep striving. I'm Simone, and today we're continuing our conversation about autism spectrum disorder with Ilana Gershlovitz, a mother, caregiver, educator, autism advocate, and author of Saving My Sons, A Journey with Autism. She is also the director and founder of the Star School Academy. Last time on Out the Box, we explored some of the everyday realities of raising an autistic child, including sensory challenges, sleep difficulties, and behaviors that can sometimes be very difficult to understand. We also discussed the important idea that behavior is actually a form of communication. There were two areas we didn't have enough time to explore fully. The first was the DSM-5 diagnostic criteria for the levels of severity in ASD, as well as the levels of support that would be needed for an autistic child depending on the level of severity that they are at. This helps us to illustrate the spectrum of autism and helps us to see when autism is severe and when it is subtle. The second was SIB, self-injurious behavior, something that many families may find frightening or distressing and most often very difficult to understand. Today, we'll explore what the support levels mean and the factors that may contribute to self-injurious behavior. But most importantly, we'll focus on understanding the individual and their support needs beyond the diagnosis. So joining me once again is Ilana Gershlovitz, as I said, the director and founder of the Star Academy. Ilana, welcome back.
So lovely to be again.
We've really been learning so much over the past few episodes, and I want to tell our listeners to please go to the Chai FM website, and under Out the Box, Simone Herring, you will find the podcasts. Please listen from episode one. We are doing a series of episodes about autism with Ilana, so I think it would be very beneficial that if you have missed episode one and two, do go and listen to it. Ilana, understanding the DSM-5 and the autism spectrum. I want us to look at the two categories that that come up when I was trying to research everything. And again, I say that I don't come as a professional. I just come as a mom and someone who's passionate about children with difficulties. The first category is social communication and social interaction. And the second category is restricted and repetitive behaviors of certain interests and activities that autistic children tend to have. Could you tell us a little bit more about what each of those categories include? And then we'll move on to the, well, let's not move on yet. Let's begin with the social communication and social interaction.
Okay, so let's start at the very beginning. Every year a child has a birthday, more and more is expected of them developmentally in all the areas of development, in cognition, in language, in social skills, in academic skills, in adaptive skills. All these different domains affect each other, motor skills. If we talk about social communication and social interaction, as you very rightly highlighted, that is one of the categories that is investigated when an autism diagnosis is made. We're going to look at, can the child or individual pick up basic social cues? Can they talk about different topics of interest? Can they establish and maintain friendships? Do they understand humor and jokes? Can they join a conversation? Can they end a conversation? How do they take constructive criticism on board? So these social skills are very important for an individual to be successful in their family life, at school, in community relationships. And very often, children and individuals on the spectrum are deficit in those skills. But the good news, Simone, is that the
good, I'm glad. I'm glad there's yes. good news.
Those developmental skills can absolutely be taught. In a young developing child, a social skill is compliance. Come here, sit down. Joint attention. The speech therapist will know about this. Imitation skills. Those are the very early social skills. And then as a child develops and becomes older, more and more is expected of them developmentally in the social skills domain. For example, we have a lesson in our program at the Star Academy called winning and losing. You know, a social skill is not to have a complete absolute meltdown and break the tennis racket over the child's head because they lost the tennis match, right? So we want to teach appropriate social skills. Talking about the restricted and repetitive patterns of behavior, yes. which you also highlighted there.
And is that the second area?
That's a second area. In a young developing child, you're going to see they're going to be lining up their toys. They're going to be, like if they play outside in the playground, they go up the slide, down the slide, around the jungle gym, on the swing, off. Up the slide, down the slide, around the jungle gym, on the swing, off. So it's a lot of repetitive behavior. Running in a circle, walking on their toes. They very much want to stick to routine. If they go shopping with their mom, if she always goes to Pick and Pay first and then Woolworths, and this was my son David, God help me if I changed and I wanted to go, you know, to Woolworths before I went to Pick and Pay. So it's been very, very stuck on routine, and that's how they manage to control their environment.
Right. Is that also within the brain that that repetitive behavior, how does it actually develop?
Such a good question. It's a little bit different for each child and each individual. What's driving that repetitive behavior? That's why we do a functional analysis of every child's behavior so we can determine what is driving that behavior. Is it escape? Is it attention? Is it an automatic behavior? Is it because they want access to a tangible? The function of a behavior can be a little bit different for every child or individual. Also depends on the context and the circumstances. But what's the bottom line? Missing developmental skills drive behaviors, like repetitive behaviors. Right. So if a child or individual is missing developmental skills in social or motor or cognition or language, they're going to engage in behaviors that are inappropriate because of missing skills. Right. So at the end of the day, how we address repetitive behaviors is to identify the missing skills that's driving the repetitive behaviors. For example, a young developing child may not know how to play appropriately with toys. They may not know. They may not have what we call functional pretend play. That means that they will engage in repetitive play.
Right.
We have to teach them functional pretend play, and that's how you'll change them engaging in those repetitive behaviors.
Okay.
We need to teach appropriate behavior, and how we do that is to identify missing skills and teach them.
And as life goes and as the child gets older, as you mentioned about the birthdays, life, understanding life and understanding social interactions becomes more difficult.
Yes, yes. But Simone, wow, actually, I can share something with your listeners today.
Please do.
Today is actually David's birthday.
Happy birthday, David.
It is a very hard day for us because it has been an extremely hard journey for any parent raising a child on the spectrum. You know, that birthday brings so much anxiety, especially when he was younger. We used to be so anxious about what the future will or won't hold. Mm. And we have a tradition in our home that we actually celebrate David's birthday the day before his birthday. So on the 23rd, usually, the day before, we celebrate his birthday. We do his cake. He gets balloons. He opens presents so that David can have a day. But on his actual birthday, we get to just be left alone because, you know, David wouldn't have the cognitive understanding that many individuals, typically developing children, have. And we caregivers, we're not parents, so a birthday can be a very difficult day.
Ilana, just clear that up for me. When you say you're caregivers, you're not parents, how do you differentiate the two?
Oof, wait till you hear the answer. Parents raise their children, and then the children reach the age of 18 or 21, and you let them fly. They have a level of functionality and independence. You let them go. They go to university. They have boyfriends and girlfriends. They're going to have a job. They're going to live on their own. They're going to be self-sufficient. When you're a caregiver, that's not going to happen. The child's going to live with you for always, and they need a certain level of support depending on the child or individual's severity of the diagnosis.
That is really profound, because the idea that your job is to look after David for the rest of his life is quite confronting.
It is. We've kind of settled into it, and we're happy in our life. You know, you kind of get used to it. I must just share that I always joke to say that I can't even get old, because I'm not even allowed to die. We can talk more about it after
Botox.
The breaks.
It's really important to remember that autism is called a spectrum, because no two autistic individuals are exactly alike. When did you first notice differences in your child's communication, behavior, or sensory issues? You know, what stood out for you? Send us your messages and voice notes during the break to 061-895-1019.
Out the Box is brought to you by the South African Jewish Museum. Preserving our past, celebrating the present, and inspiring our future.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Out the Box. Today, we're breaking down autism spectrum disorder from support levels and diagnostic criteria to anxiety, self-injurious behavior, and family life. For many families, the real challenge lies in understanding behaviors that can appear alarming or overwhelming. We're joined by Ilana Gershlevitz, and she's going to assist us in unpacking the truth that parents have to face when raising a dyslexic child. Ilana, I did read in the book about the birthday, and what struck me was that people phoned you to say happy birthday, and they didn't direct the happy birthday to David, which is where the happy birthday should go. Why did that happen? Why do you think people do that?
People think it's socially accepted to wish the child happy birthday. And I think they knew they couldn't speak to David because he was nonverbal and they wouldn't get a response. So they automatically thought that if they wished the parents happy birthday, it would be honoring David. But it actually just did the opposite. It really hurt us very, very deeply. And it would be just such a cold bucket of water and a reminder that David couldn't answer for himself on his birthday. You know, it's so difficult to know what to say in challenging situations, Simone. Like, for example, Rachel Poland Goldberg, Hirsch's mom.
Yes, yes.
She said people would ask her, how is she? And it would be like, how dare you ask me this question? Can't you see the knife in my heart? Can't you see the dagger in my heart? She was appalled by the fact that people would ask her that question. And some people can think, but like, you know, we're just trying to be polite. We don't really know actually what else to say. And it's nice to hear from her how that made her feel. And it's so understandable that people could say, how do you feel? But for her, it was a cold bucket of water. It was like a stab in her heart, another dagger in her heart.
Yeah.
So honestly, I think it's difficult for people to know what to say and what not to say.
Yeah, there is that awkwardness. Marissa Moritz also spoke about Isaac, and she felt the same experience. But she did go on to say that she's come to terms with it, in that, as you say, people just don't know what to say. I also came across in all my research that I was doing that there are there are characteristics that can look very different from one individual to another, which is one of the reasons autism is described as a spectrum. Correct?
Correct.
I then caught a clip on your Facebook page, which is Autism, What Now? And I urge all the listeners to go and check it out. Dame Uta Frith, one of the world's leading autism researchers, helped to shape modern understanding of autism. You know, she was a pioneer in her work on social cognition, communication, and brain development. The research into the cognitive characteristics of autism, particularly the social understanding and the theory of mind, she asked the question and answered the question about what is the spectrum. Some children do have social difficulties. I know that ADHD children have social difficulties and they can't read the cues and they don't understand irony. So as you said with the jokes, it kind of goes over their head because they are so literal. Tell us about what she said about that spectrum and almost the overdiagnosing of autism.
I'm so glad we're talking about her because she was very much part of developing the DSM and she's coming out and saying it's obsolete.
Mm.
It's not being used for the reason it was created in the first place. And it's really blocking access to individuals on the spectrum who are so desperate and in need of access to proper treatments and services when we have a larger group on the spectrum who are very high functioning. Their parents are not caregivers at all.
Right,
they parent.
Right.
But they have, you know, social skills deficits. They have perspective taking issues. They can have social anxiety. And so they being labeled as autism, and it's completely blurring the whole reason that the diagnosis of autism was created.
Correct.
It's become obsolete.
Yeah.
And it's going to change someone. We spoke about Robert Kennedy, and it's going to change. So I welcome this.
Yes.
Because the woke in America, and they really, really push the narrative of autism being the superpower. And, you know, it really isn't. Even for a lot of the higher functioning individuals, they can have severe depression. The teenagers get kicked out of school. You know, they can have suicidal ideation. This is not a superpower.
I think they're taking that whole superpower, as we said on the last episode, from movies and films and Elon Musk. You know, it's not a superpower. It's an affliction. It's an affliction that parents have to deal with every single day.
It's very hard.
Very hard diagnosis. So do you think that the Asperger's diagnosis shouldn't have been removed?
Definitely shouldn't have been removed.
Right.
I think it's one of the big reasons we're having this conversation today.
Because I was reading Tony Atwood's book, and I felt like a lot of the children who are not autistic, per se, they don't have all the characteristics, but they have some of them. So the Asperger's diagnosis, the children kind of fitted more easily into that category.
Correct.
So I do urge all the listeners to go onto your website, well, onto your Facebook page to listen to Dame Uta Frith, because she was really fantastic and she really speaks very well. Ilana, one behavior that many parents hear about, they hear about it very early in their autism journey, and that's stimming. And it's often misunderstood. What exactly is stimming, and why is it important for parents to understand it?
It is a self-regulation strategy. We do try to teach the children and individuals appropriate ways to express their emotions, what they're thinking and what they're feeling. Sometimes it can be driven by sensory issues. But ultimately, Simone, when you have missing skills, you're going to use behavior to communicate.
Because you cannot verbalize.
Exactly. So in a young developing child, and David used to make his body stiff and then shake his hands and stiffen his face, and it looked like he was having a seizure when he wasn't, and that was his stim, and his whole body would go stiff, and it would cause quite a scene when we went out in the community, and he would, you know, go into that position when he was excited about something. But he was engaging in that behavior because he didn't have the words to say, wow, look at that, I'm so excited. That's why we address these kind of issues, to try and find a way to teach the child an appropriate way to communicate. Behavior is always a communication, and there's always going to be a deficit. And we want to also try and help them to express themselves in a way that is going to be less attention seeking,
I hear what you're saying, but in a way, I think that the hand flapping or the rocking or the spinning of objects and the fidgeting, I think it lends itself to two things which you spoke about. It lends itself to the excitement of being present in a situation that is exciting for the autistic child. But as you said, it's also the sensory overload, the anxiety and the stress. Do we need to change that, Ilana?
We do need to change it, because society and our community and the world is very judgmental, and we're not going to change that. And we do need to change it. Absolutely. I'm a big proponent for changing it.
Is it not a healthy coping mechanism?
Absolutely not. And you know, Simone, they're actually very high-functioning children that we've had at Star Academy, where they have good language and they can be in school. I'm thinking of one child specifically that we treated, and one of his big issues was he'd hand flap. And you know, for a six-year-old who's quite at a high functioning level and able to have a conversation with peers, hand flapping is going to contribute to him not being able to make friends and to the other kids thinking that he's weird. And we can help him to get the same sensation he's getting from hand flapping by teaching him to squeeze stress balls in his pockets. We're not saying, we can find ways to help them get that sensory sensation and not look inappropriate.
Right. We're going to be moving into self-injurious behavior, which is quite confronting and debilitating for autistic children. And for many parents, the hardest part isn't always the meltdown itself. It's the judgment, as Ilana was saying, that often comes with it. So I'd like you to think about any kind of stimming behaviors during the break and send us a WhatsApp on 061-895-1019.
Out the Box is brought to you by the South African Jewish Museum. Preserving our past, celebrating the present, and inspiring our future.
I'm Simone, and you're listening to Out the Box on Chai FM 101.9. We are speaking to Ilana Gershlovitz on autism. We're taking it a little further, and we are addressing stimming, self-injurious behavior, and also when self-injurious behavior doesn't only stay with the self, but sometimes, unfortunately, when a child is feeling so overwhelmed, the meltdowns affect other people, the caregivers and the parents and the siblings, on both an emotional and a physical level. So, Ilana, this is quite a tough one. And before I actually get to that, you know, I have my steps that I want to go through, and I don't want to miss this because I think it will lead to the understanding of self-injurious behavior and etc. But there's an important thing that we need to understand that parents worry about, and that is the three levels of severity in autism, as well as how the three levels of severity demand different types of support. Now, I saw this in the back of your book, which was fascinating, and I'd like you to just explain what those levels are in terms of severity as well as support.
The level one would be requiring support. Level two is requiring substantial support. And then level three would be requiring very substantial support. So my son, David, requires very substantial support. And so the support needs really differ depending on how the child presents.
Okay. So a parent would go for a diagnosis, and per that diagnosis, they would know what type of support the child would need. And I imagine that would guide them to different types of schools that would be appropriate for that.
Yes and no, because, for example, Star Academy, we work with all three of those levels. And also to encourage the parents, if you get a diagnosis and you have a level one or a level three, we always want to work towards improving the level. So at the end of the day, an autism diagnosis is an autism diagnosis.
Yes.
It's a serious diagnosis. It's a diagnosis really that requires the right interventions. Mm. I'm a very big proponent of applied behavior analysis for all of those different areas. We've learned from the Americans, identifying the missing skills, working with the child every single day. I think, Simone, where we fall short is that therapies that work with the child once or twice a week is not going to really achieve results.
Right, I agree. And even I've seen, even with my therapy in dyslexia, you know, once a week or twice a week really isn't enough. It needs to be intense and regular. If we then go on to what is quite confronting, I received this WhatsApp message. I always say I love the WhatsApp messages. Please keep them coming. It really adds to the show. And again, it is anonymous. So the message goes, "Good morning, Simone and Ilana. My son is 10 years old and autistic, and we're only just starting to experience severe meltdowns. Recently, when he becomes overwhelmed, he started banging his head against the wall and hitting himself in the face. As a mom, I find it terrifying. I don't know if he's anxious, frustrated, or in pain, or trying to tell me something that he just can't put into words. When it happens in public, I feel completely helpless. People stare and I feel that they're judging me, even though I'm doing everything I can to calm him. I feel like I should stay home and never take him out." Ilana, that behavior, which is self-injurious, is very loaded, because if it happens in public, people look at you and think, can't you discipline your child? You know, honestly, can't you just control him? So I want to thank the mom for sending that message in. And I want to ask you, Ilana, from your professional expertise and your experience as David's mother and caregiver, help us to understand what might be driving meltdowns and self-injurious behavior and how parents can respond when it happens.
The meltdown is coming from a place where, again, the child is skills deficit. They don't have emotional regulation. They don't have the emotional coping skills. And they have now tipped. With David, you know, we had many episodes in public where
tell us about them.
He would hit himself, he would hit his head, he would try to break his nose. I used to walk around with an emoji cushion that he could actually take that cushion and squeeze it into his face instead of taking his hands and trying to break his nose. So with self-injurious behavior, we are always trying to design behavior intervention plans for the children so that they're not injuring themselves. I mean, Simone, a child who's head banging frequently can cause a concussion. You know, we've had kids where they've had to start wearing helmets. I mean, it's very serious. Usually it's medically automated, and it's coming from an automatic place. Again, as behavior analysts, we analyze behavior. So we're going to try to determine for each child, and that's what we did with David. Where is this behavior coming from? Again, I'm going to say that serious meltdown is a communication. The child is trying to communicate something to their caregivers or to their parent. David used to hit himself. He used to want to hit the ABA therapist that was with him. We actually put a punching bag in his workstation so that he could hit the punching bag. Because in these circumstances, especially when it's automatic, Simone, if you have an eye twitch, that's automatic. You can't stop an eye. If your eye's ticking and it's twitching.
Yeah, I have a son with Tourette's, and his eyes, his tick now is his eyes, and which is very, very open, and people notice it a lot. And he just can't help it, as you say.
It's automatic. Exactly. So if the self-injurious behavior is automatic, you can't stop them from doing it. Yeah, it's different now to when I was talking about the stimming, and it could be for excitement. This is now an automatic behavior. So again, every behavior needs a functional analysis so we can determine what's driving the behavior. With self-injurious behavior, yes, it's for communication, but now we need to... We can't stop. You couldn't hold David's hand and stop him from wanting to hit. But we would find an appropriate outlet to hit a punching bag. That's more appropriate than him hitting himself, you know, or get an emoji cushion so that he could push the emoji cushion into his face. We're always trying to find appropriate replacement behavior.
So it's not almost a response to the person. It isn't. It's his behavior. And he can take that frustration out on a person or an emoji cushion or a punching bag. Am I right in saying that you are putting something in front of him and that is a safer thing for him to punch? Does he automatically move from punching himself or trying to break his nose into punching the punching bag?
Absolutely. So initially it's prompted, but in applied behavior analysis, ABA, we have prompt fading procedures. So then you fade to, you know, initially you'll hand over hand the child to placing his hands on the punching bag. Then you'll just point to the punching bag, and then you want the child eventually independently to go to the punching bag themselves. So you want to make them independent.
So that's really interesting when you speak about the two behaviors, the stimming, which you aim to change, or for the child to find a less obtrusive way of stimming, to a child who's having meltdowns and self-injurious behavior. If any of this resonates with you, please send us your messages, your suggestions, your comments. We love to hear from you. The WhatsApp number is 061-895-1019.
Out the Box is brought to you by the South African Jewish Museum. Preserving our past, celebrating the present, and inspiring our future.
Ilana, as you said about the self-injurious behavior, that it's a behavior because the child is feeling something and is not able to communicate it because there are no verbal skills. So you did tell a story about David's iPad. And being in a situation where somebody came to you and said to you, you cannot use this iPad here. Can you expand on the story just to give the listeners an idea of how parents are judged and how autistic children are judged and the lack of understanding?
Absolutely. So just to recap, what may drive self-injurious behavior can be that the child has anxiety or sensory overload or pain or frustration or changes in routine, or they're emotionally overwhelmed. And David would experience all those things I've just listed and not have a verbal way of expressing himself. But and that's why we taught him to express himself on an iPad. Mm. But Simone, a verbal child, even though they're verbal, if language is not fluent, it may still require effort for them to go and access their words. So even though they can engage in a conversation, if it's a child in these kind of situations will always go to the easiest route. Mm. So if it's easier to just push the other child or just lash out in that moment and hit the other child or hit themselves, that's what they're going to default to because their skills are not fluent.
Right.
Okay. Now let's talk about my specific situation. We were in Cape Town. We go to a new shul And Martin goes into Davin, and I'm sitting with David, who was around 9 years old at the time, and Ellie, who was around 6 years old at the time, in the children's service room. And David's got his iPad, and he uses that to communicate. So he will push buttons, or he'll type, and it's got voice output, and that's how he's able to express himself. But there are games on the iPad as well, but he's using it to communicate with me, and a lady comes up to me and she says, "I'm so sorry, we keep Shabbos at the shul and your son is not allowed to play on his iPad on Shabbos. This is not the message we want to send our other Jewish children. Please, could you either get him to stop being on his iPad or I ask you to leave."
Okay. So what is the response to that? I mean, how do you even
I was frozen in time. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't even stand up. Another mother heard and she came over to me. My heart was breaking. Another mother came over to me and she said, "Listen, I can see your son can't speak. I can see he's using his iPad to communicate. Don't go anyway. Calm down." And she went after the other parent to tell them, you know, actually, this is a situation. And then that parent came to apologize to me. But it was too late. But
they all say that a whole heart is often a broken heart. And isn't that so true? Because I think that parents with children who are autistic experience heartbreak every day. You know, I think just to get through the day and say, "Gosh, I got through the day without an incident, I'm so grateful for that." Ilana, when you speak about co-regulation, so, for example, if David is having a meltdown and do you allow him to finish the meltdown, or do you I guess that the boxing bag would be a way of co-regulating. But for instance, you were in an airport, as I read in the book, and on the way to Mauritius, and David had a meltdown. Why did he have that meltdown? Do you stop the meltdown, or do you co-regulate it so that it kind of contains David?
Good questions. The best option is really going to be actually what we call antecedent modification. So trying to prevent the behavior from occurring in the first place. Mm. So in applied behavior analysis, we have behavior management principles. One of them is ABC, antecedent behavior consequence. We have a behavior. If we change A or C, the antecedent or the consequence to the behavior, can we change the behavior? Now, antecedent modification would have been to show David a timer and to have set the timer to explain to him, this is how long we're going to wait in the queue before we board the airplane. And okay, I could have set it a little bit longer than anticipated so that the timer didn't go off and we'd still be standing in the queue, right? You know? So antecedent modification, so that you're trying to prevent the behavior. The children who've got cognitive ability, we try to teach emotional coping skills. For example, you will teach them before the meltdown and when you're having sessions with them, zones of regulation. If you're in the blue zone, you're very happy. If you're in the green zone, you're okay, but you're not so happy anymore. If you're in the orange zone, you're just before, you're like upset, right, and this is not looking cool. And then like in the red zone, you've tipped. So we teach them when you're in the different colors, what can you do? So we teach them not to get to the place where they've tipped. So in the orange zone, you can put up your hand and ask for help. You can breathe 3 times. You can ask a teacher if you can walk to the bathroom. We try to teach them to recognize how they're feeling upon themselves so that they don't have to reach the red zone, which is the meltdown. Mm. Now we're at the airport in Mauritius. David is melting down. He's screaming. He's hitting himself. People are staring. You know, poor Ellie, who is his sibling, doesn't know whether to hide under the chair, under his jersey. If the earth could swallow up and swallow all of us, that would be great. Applied behavior analysis will tell you that the more attention a bad behavior gets, whether that attention is positive or negative, the more the behavior will escalate. So quite honestly, when the child is melting down, the behavior intervention plan may very well be that you have to put that behavior on extinction. Because if you're going to give it attention, and especially in public, the child's going to know, oh, when we're in public, then mom, shh, 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 no, you know. So it's
And Ilana, the fact that they are so in tune to that.
Very much. Oh, David is very in tune to that. You know, there we are at the Mauritius airport, and I mean, the scene unfolding is something for Netflix. I mean, I just think we, if I remember correctly, we just sat it out. You know, there's not much we can do. Once the child is quiet, even if it's for a second, and when David would just take a breath just for 1 second, good boy, look, and this is what we can do. Look, I'm going to put you on the timer. It's going to be 5 more minutes. But I would also write to him, yes. and even to children who are verbal. Once they've tipped, they're not auditory processing anymore. So actually what worked for David would be I would type on his iPad, and then try to direct him to read the words, because when he tipped, he wasn't auditory processing anymore.
Ilana, I have a question. When you say he types and he can read, for a child who's nonverbal, the beginning of reading is hearing sounds, phonemes in words, and then being able to put them together or separate them. How did you teach David to write? Because that almost comes at the end of learning that language in the beginning, then you learn to speak, and then you write.
Every child is different. David can't write, but he can type. So I mean type.
I mean type.
David's got splinter skills. Children on the spectrum have splinter skills. David could do decoding, patterning, blending, phonemic awareness. He was actually, at a very young age, obsessed with the alphabet. He used to run his hand on the wall over the letters. He was drawn to letters and words.
He was very multisensory.
Very much so. And he absolutely loved words and the alphabet. They were also in order. You know, the order of the alphabet is always the same. And again,
and they would like that, I would imagine.
A lot of children on the spectrum are drawn to words,
yeah,
you know, and
yeah,
that he did find a way to communicate with us, and he does type and use typing as a way to tell us his basic wants and needs.
So his hearing came into play in then learning how to type. The fact that he couldn't verbalize, you know, was a skill that he was missing.
Exactly. So why can't he verbalize? Because of the motor planning of speech. With autism, and particularly nonverbal children, they're not having signaling between the brain and the muscle of the face for speech. Right. They don't choose to be non-speaking. They are nonverbal.
Right. After the break, we'll be turning our attention to another challenging stage, as if the previous challenging stages were not enough. We're looking at autistic children and puberty and the teenage years. How do hormonal changes affect autistic teenagers? And why can adolescents sometimes become really, really difficult for both the children and the parents? Stay with us and we will challenge that question.
Out the Box is brought to you by the South African Jewish Museum. Preserving our past, celebrating the present, and inspiring our future.
Now it's 9 minutes.
Okay, so we're going to deal with adolescents. No, you did brilliantly. We're going to deal with adolescents, and then we're going to go into the epilepsy.
Fine.
Where I want you to say, this is where medication has a place.
Fine.
Not necessarily for the autistic, but okay.
Fine.
That last part when I came back, can you just cut it out? It didn't sound good.
Uh-oh.
Sounded weird.
I'm trying to go back to you. That's why I went back to the one thing, to just give it back, because I want to say the things you've summarized.
No, that's for me.
Okay.
That's for me. Okay. You're listening to Simone and Out the Box, and we're continuing our essential conversation about autism with Ilana Gershlovitz, who really is a professional in autism spectrum disorder. Ilana, puberty and the teenage years, for any parent, that is an impossible time. How did puberty affect David's behavior, and what should we understand about the impact that adolescents can have on autistic children?
David had increased anxiety, more emotional sensitivity and increased behavioral challenges during his teenage years. He was like a wild beast. If I had a dart and we could dart him, that would have been cool.
I think most parents feel like that without the autism.
it you know, also David was a 13, 14-year-old going on 2 years old.
Mm. When the brain is so behind and the body is, you know, running ahead.
You asked me, how did puberty affect David? Let me tell you how puberty affected me.
Mm.
It was very heart-wrenching for me to see him grow pubic hair and hair under his arms and start getting a little bit of a moustache. It was awful.
Mm.
It just reminded me that I wasn't beating autism in the way that I'd set out to do, and I had to dig deeper and work harder to navigate.
Mm, mm. I imagine that that was very difficult. Your child who cognitively is at the age of two, but all these hormonal challenges or changes are coming up, and now you're looking at a man, but his brain and his ability his inability to speak just must highlight, you know, it's so incongruous that you see these two things happening at the same time.
It's awful.
Ilana, you know, we haven't discussed girls. And coming to puberty here, we've been speaking about boys mainly.
Mm, mm.
Firstly, are boys more susceptible to autism? And for girls, is it more subtle or is it completely different?
Boys are more susceptible to autism. I think the ratio would be around like 1 in 4 will be a girl, where 3 in 4 will be boys.
Right.
Don't ask me to completely explain that. It's got something to do with I'm not even sure, but okay. We know that you've got me.
Yes.
But I do, you know, there are more boys than girls. The girls that I've come across can be very severe. It can be a very, very severe. I wouldn't say the girls are, you know, on the higher end of the spectrum usually. The ones I've come across, there have been a lot of severely autistic girls. Mm. It's a very sad situation when they're in their teenage years and they get their period. Like, how are you meant to explain to them now, you know? So,
and also that self-cleanliness, you know. I read somewhere that you have to remind them to shower and to wash their hair. Is that something real?
All those adaptive skills can be taught. And I'm glad we're talking about that. And, you know, David is profoundly autistic, but because of the ABA he received for 20 years, he can bath himself, dress himself, feed himself, go to the toilet himself. And that took intervention and time. But then also if we talk about the higher individuals on the spectrum and puberty, and they, you know, it's, as you said, for any child coming into puberty, it's confusing. Their body changes. That's where those individuals really need the support, because then they can land up with very big issues. I don't want to be a boy anymore. I don't want to be a girl anymore. That's where those children really do need more support to carry them through those teenage years, to get through their bodies changing. And because they're on the spectrum, they're finding it even harder to deal with those changes.
I understand. Especially with a girl getting a period. You know, she doesn't want to be a girl because she doesn't want to have to deal with a period. And she's, you know, she wants this to go away. Very briefly, the difference between OCD and autistic children's need for rigidity in play, like you said, lining up the cars. And you mentioned last time when you had people over, David insisted that they sat in a certain chair. So when is it autism and that rigidity, and when is it obsessive compulsive behavior?
Well, the obsessive compulsive behavior is really an exaggerated expression of behavior that will interrupt the child's functionality and the family to the point where it really requires a treatment and a solution, because it's impacting the child and the family. It's interrupting.
It's debilitating.
It's debilitating, exactly. A little bit of rigid rigidity, you know, pick your battles. So if that's what makes them comfortable and gives them safety, okay. But with the OCD, it really can go too far. You know, David can get into certain habits where, like, the door must be unlocked. But if we on holiday and we in an apartment and we want to be safe and we need to lock the door, we need to lock the door.
Yes.
So I remember when he was, you know, 8 years old and he wanted the door, he didn't want us to lock the door, but we wanted to lock the door. And he'd wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning, go and unlock the door. And I was wrestling him to the floor,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So
I get that. And I also experienced with my own son and OCD, which was quite interesting because it kind of goes against what you were just saying. When my son is at home and he has all these different routines, which I think comfort him in a way, but also debilitate him. If he goes to a different environment, if he goes on camp, for instance, he doesn't do the obsessive compulsive behavior there. And I find it quite fascinating. And I suppose that if he was there for a longer time, it would move over or become something new.
What I can say for this, whether it's rigidity or whether it's OCD, is at the end of the day, we always need to be working towards a child's independence and functionality. So just a quick example. David wants us to repetitively answer questions over and over and over and over. He asks us the same question a million times, and he'll get really upset if you don't answer. It doesn't matter that you've answered. He asks you immediately again. So what we learned to do, and this is where the ABA came in, is that we'd record the answer for him on a memo on his phone. He uses a phone now, not an iPad.
Yes.
It's a lot more practical for his age. And if he asks the question, we wouldn't answer verbally. We would tap to the memo initially to prompt him. And then he would press a recording, and it would be a recording of my voice giving him the answer. Now, when he asks the question once, I give him the answer. And if he asks the question a second time, we'll immediately point to the phone. I actually, Simon, now see that he'll ask it once, I give the answer, and he wants to ask a second time, but he doesn't. He goes to the voice memo and plays the voice memo. So he's giving himself what he needs. And again, if he needs to hear 70 times the answer, we can't stop him from needing that.
Yes.
Okay, because it's such an OCD that he should hear it, that calms his anxiety.
Yeah. And they perseverate.
Exactly. So anxiety drives the OCD. So we can't stop David from needing that answer 70 times. But where we can intervene is to make David independent so that he can give himself the answer without needing to depend on us.
How clever.
Out the Box is brought to you by the South African Jewish Museum. Preserving our past, celebrating the present, and inspiring our future.
Theory of mind. Can you just take, because we are going to have to wrap up soon, but, you know, I read in Dr. Frith's, on her podcast that she was giving, she spoke about theory of mind. Can you very briefly, because I am going to move it into the next episode as well as David's epilepsy and medication, but let's just wrap up on theory of mind.
It's the ability to understand that other people have their own thoughts, feelings, beliefs, knowledge, intentions, and perspectives, the big word perspectives, and that these may be different from your own. It's a concept really in developmental psychology, and the individual on the spectrum struggles to take perspective. Let's talk more about it in the next episode.
And also the ADHD child finds it difficult to put himself in another person's shoes.
I can quickly give an example. If you're at somebody's home and you don't say, okay, bye, I'm leaving now. You just disappear, right?
Yes.
The person would think like, oh my gosh, where did you go?
Panic,
right?
You know?
What happened? Like, they maybe stepped out to the bathroom and while they step out to the bathroom, you disappear. If you're able to take perspective, you're going to be able to put yourself in that person's shoes and think, if I don't say goodbye, what is that person going to think when they come back from the bathroom?
Right.
So often we need to teach a higher functioning individual on the spectrum perspective taking.
Okay. So Ilana, the more we understand from you and from your story, the better equipped we are to support our children with compassion and confidence and teach them how to respond to children with autism. I'd like to leave you with these words, often associated with autism researcher Dr. Barry Present, because I did do the, I asked chat, how do I pronounce this name? Anyway, it goes like this. The most important thing we can do is understand the meaning behind the behavior. Ilana, thank you so much for joining us again. We look forward to episode 4. Until next time, remember that when we seek to understand before we judge, we create a world where autistic individuals and their families can feel they belong too. I leave you with Phil Collins, "You'll Be in My Heart." Take care.